So we begin this evening where we left off last time when Sri Aurobindo was describing the three great realizations possible to the yogin, the fruit of Adhyatma Yoga, the inner practice, so that we realize what is true individually, the nature of the soul, the nature of the conscious spirit inside. The nature of that same spirit which is extended into the universe, the cosmic dimension of the timeless eternal. And then, of course, the transcendent in its own being. And we've seen Sri Aurobindo discuss this in The Life Divine and in other places in the synthesis of yoga, because when we look at the nature of being, we see it not only from our own psychological vantage and the truth of our own individual being as formulations in microcosmic form. But also that the transcendent is the originating source, the origining source of both cosmos and individual. So if the individual expresses the cosmic, but is a truth in its own being, and the cosmic a larger truth, still both terms come from that transcendent. And so we begin with that tonight. If a departure from the world and its activities, a supreme release and quietude were the sole aim of the seeker, the three great fundamental realizations would be sufficient for the fulfillment of his spiritual life. Concentrated in them alone, he could suffer all other divine or mundane knowledge to fall away from him and himself, unencumbered, depart into the eternal silence. So, if all we had to do was realize the sheer spirit, we could withdraw, leave the world. No more are we troubled. But he has to take account of the world and its activities, learn what divine truth there may be behind them, and reconcile that apparent opposition between the divine truth and the manifest creation, which is the starting point of most spiritual experience. So, if we find the truth above, the truth of essential being, all peace, all light, and compare it with the dark contrariety that this world presents, then we're struck by the discontinuity of the two. If that's the only real, how does this happen? But it can be reconciled, Sri Aurobindo hints here. And that is the larger task of the yogin, not simply to gain release from the world in an inner sense, but to come back and solve the manifest problems. Here, on each line of approach that he can take, he is confronted with a constant duality, a separation between two terms of existence that seem to be opposites, and their opposition to be the very root of the riddle of the universe. Later, he may and does discover that these are the two poles of one being, connected by two simultaneous currents of energy, negative and positive, in relation to each other. Their interaction, the very condition for the manifestation of what is within the being. Their reunion, the appointed means for the reconciliation of life's discords and for the discovery of the integral truth of which he is the seeker. So, this is a yoga which would unite cosmic, individual, and all terms of being in one. Sri Aurobindo has demarcated this from the fundamental realizations. This is one of those instrumental aspects that really reveals the nature of the riddle. We can't find out what is the purpose of the universe simply by remaining fixed in the fundamental realizations. We have to find that which links that to this. And that's the instrumentalities which will resolve the problem of dualism. If that is true, how is this true? What relation could they possibly have with each other? He continues now, for on one side, he is aware of this self everywhere, this everlasting spirit substance, Brahman, the eternal, the same self-existence here in time, behind each appearance he sees or senses, and timeless beyond the universe. We've been quoting the Gita, so again, chapter 6, verse 20, and chapter 6 again, verse 29. He has this strong, overpowering experience of a self that is neither our limited ego nor our mind, life, or body, worldwide, but not outwardly phenomenal, yet to some spirit sense in him, more concrete than any form or phenomenon, universal, yet not dependent for its being on anything in the universe, or on the whole totality of the universe. If all this were to disappear, its extinction would make no difference to this eternal of his constant intimate experience. And you may remember the story about Janaka in the Upanishad, where it's the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, where he is sitting deeply composed in his experience of the self, and his ministry approaches him and says, "Sire, the palace is on fire." He doesn't move. They move to wake him, to stir him again. "Sire, the palace is on fire. Your kingdom is on fire." And he opens his eyes and says, "If all the kingdom were burnt to ashes, not a hair of my real self would be singed." This is a deep truth. And Janaka is the model by which we compare spiritual people who govern worldly affairs. So the first thing is to have that experience where one discovers the innate self within, that's self-created, self-aware, the self which is common to all things. Living in that, one can be free from the sense of gain or loss. But Janaka also was dynamic and governed the actual kingdom and did, by all accounts, a great job at it. So one can be spiritual and yet be active and dynamic in the world as well. Sri Aurobindo goes on here. He is sure of an inexpressible self-existence, which is the essence of himself and all things. He is intimately aware of an essential consciousness of which thinking mind and life sense and body sense are only partial and diminished figures, a consciousness with an illimitable force in it of which all energies are the outcome, but which is yet not explained or accounted for by the sum or power or nature of all these energies together. He feels, he lives in an inalienable, self-existent bliss, which is not this lesser transient joy or happiness or pleasure. So again, self-aware, self-actuating, a self-existence, a sat, a consciousness which has an illimitable force, chit shakti, and a self-existent bliss. So again, Sri Aurobindo speaks to us of Sat-Chit-Ananda, which, as the old Vedantic text states, if you can say anything about that, it is that it is. It is that it is aware, and it is that its nature is delight. A changeless, imperishable infinity, a timeless eternity, a self-awareness which is not this receptive and reactive or tentacular mental consciousness, but is behind it and above it and present to below it, even in what we call in conscience, a oneness in which there is no possibility of any other existence, are the fourfold character of this settled experience. So these are the four aspects of sheer spiritual realization. Even brought into the immanence of the universe, these are aspects of the infinite, the eternal, the self-aware being who is soul, S-O-L-E, singular, one. Yet, this eternal self-existence is seen by him also as a conscious time spirit bearing the stream of happenings, a self-extended spiritual space containing all things and beings, a spirit substance which is the very form and material of all that seems non-spiritual, temporary, and finite. For all that is transitory, temporal, spatial, bounded, is yet felt by him to be in its substance and energy and power, no other than the One, the Eternal, the Infinite. So behind, within all phenomena, is this single being. If you refer to it in terms of time, it is Kala. If you refer to it as that which contains all, in an ethereal sense, then it is Akasha. But always we are speaking about that one, Eka, Tad Ekam, that one of the Rig Veda. And yet, there is not only in him or before him this eternal self-aware existence, this spiritual consciousness, this infinity of self-illumined force, this timeless and endless beatitude. There is too, constant also to his experience, this universe in measurable space and time, some kind, perhaps, of boundless finite. And in it, all is transient, limited, fragmentary, plural, ignorant, exposed to disharmony and suffering, seeking vaguely for some unrealized yet inherent harmony of oneness, unconscious or half-conscious, or even when most conscious, still tied to the original ignorance and inconscience. And he would refer you to his Life Divine, where he determines how it is that the divine unrolls itself in limited self-expression and ignores its larger being and buries itself in an original ignorance from which it evolves. There is a purpose in it, and one can move from the fragmentary to the whole, from discontinuity back to oneness. So this is Sat-Chit-Ananda, extended into manifestation. The idea of a boundless finite, by the way, this is akin to Einstein's interpretation of the universe. Not that it is actually infinite, but that it is unbounded. It is without boundary. Perhaps a better way to state it. Because what is infinite could only be that transcendent, yes? And what is aware of that transcendence? He is not always in a trance of peace or bliss, And even if he were, it would be no solution, for he knows that this would still be going on outside him and yet within some larger self of him, as if forever. So it seems to be outside, extraneous to his inner being, and yet inner experience tells you, makes you feel that all exists within you when you become one with that. He finds soon that this separation in his consciousness has an immense liberative power, for by it he is no longer bound to the ignorance, the inconscience. It no longer appears to him the very nature of himself and things, but an illusion which can be overcome, or at least a temporary wrong self-experience, Maya. So, the idea of finitude, the wrong interpretation, is a temporary manifestation within the temporality of the cosmos. It is tempting to regard it as only a contradiction of the divine, an incomprehensible mystery play, mask, or travesty of the infinite. And so it irresistibly seems to his experience at times. On one side, the luminous verity of Brahman. On the other, a dark illusion of Maya. But something in him will not allow him to cut existence thus permanently in two. And looking more closely, he discovers that in this half-light or darkness, too, is the eternal. It is the Brahman who is here with this face of Maya. Suggesting again that Brahman and Maya are not antagonistic, that the duality is more apparent than real. Remember, too, where the term Brahman comes from. We take it now as the Sanskrit word that's equivalent of the Western philosophic term absolute, something that is beyond all space and time and transcendent to all manifestation. And that's true in a sense. That is in part how Brahman is interpreted. But the word comes from the Sanskrit brah, B, R with a dot under it, H. And that means what grows, what expands. And the first time we learn the word is in the Rig Veda, and it means Brahman as the creative word of the divine. And so those who are masters of the creative words of the divine in terms of their mantra and the ritual, etc., are the Brahman priests, the first order of the fourfold Chaturvarna in India. So, ancient India. So Brahman later comes to mean much more. But Brahman originally signified that which grows and grows and grows. And if you looked at the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, which really begins to deal with what the issue is with Brahman, what can we say is divine? It describes not simply the timeless, transcendent aspect, but this is Brahman, that is Brahman, and it goes on pointing at everything and finally arrives at a culmination of what this is Brahman. But on the way, everything has been included. Everything imaginable has been included, because what can you point at and say it does not have the essence of Brahman in it? So if we see something as being not Brahman, then we have undergone that twist of consciousness, which we for quick work call Maya. It's a term which means that which measures out. So Maya is not something that cheats or throws illusion on you, but takes the infinite and makes it finite. That's magical. That's wonderful. The wonder of the infinite is compressed into a small form, and it is there for you to discover. And that, of course, is what the yogin does. Launches on a process of inner self-discovery, and having awakened, perhaps more easily, to the existence of the soul, conscient with Brahman inside, then casting the gaze out, an inner gaze out, discovers that same Brahman everywhere. And there's the marvel of the cry that rings through the Upanishads, that that is Brahman. All this is Brahman. You are that. Again and again. It's a triumphant cry of self-discovery back into nature and beyond nature, to that from which nature and person come. So this is the beginning of a growing spiritual experience which reveals to him more and more that what seemed to him dark, incomprehensible Maya was all the time no other than the consciousness puissance of the eternal, timeless and illimitable beyond the universe, but spread out here under a mask of bright and dark opposites for the miracle of the slow manifestation of the divine in mind and life and matter. Consciousness puissance of the eternal, the chit shakti of sat. So we're back again to the original Satchit Ananda. All the timeless presses towards the play in time. All the timeless presses towards the play in time. So that wants to manifest here. Not simply once in terms of the involution, but is looking for its opportunity to arise from the inconscient and, meeting its descending force from above, join in the cosmic play directly. It wants to come. It's waiting for us to invite it. All in time turns upon and around the timeless spirit. We can't avoid or escape it. It is the only thing that is. We live and swim inside Brahman existence. If the separative experience was liberated, this unitive experience is dynamic and effective. So if the discovery of the self inside liberated us from ignorance, this gives us a clue as to how to act in the world. For he now not only feels himself to be in his soul substance, part of the eternal, in his essential self and spirit, entirely one with the eternal, but in his active nature, an instrumentation of its omniscient and omnipotent consciousness puissance. However bounded and relative its present play in him, he can open to a greater and greater consciousness and power of it, and to that expansion there seems to be no assignable limit. A level, spiritual and supramental, of that consciousness puissance seems even to reveal itself above him and lean to enter into contact, where there are not these trammels and limits, and its powers too are pressing upon the play in time with the promise of a greater descent and a less disguised or no longer disguised manifestation of the eternal. Bhagavad Gita, chapter 9, verse 5. The once conflicting, but now Bayun duality of Brahman Maya stands revealed to him as the first great dynamic aspect of the self of all selves, the master of existence, the lord of the world sacrifice and of his sacrifice. So this first duality between Brahman and Maya is reconciled by the experience of oneness. The self of all selves, Paramatman, the master of existence, Ishvara, the Lord of the world's sacrifice and of his sacrifice, the supreme person, Purushottama. On another line of approach, another duality presents itself to the experience of the seeker. On one side, he becomes aware of a witness, recipient, observing, experiencing consciousness, which does not appear to act, but for which all these activities inside and outside us seem to be undertaken and continue. On the other side, he is aware at the same time of an executive force or an energy of process which is seen to constitute, drive, and guide all conceivable activities and to create a myriad forms visible to us and invisible, and use them as stable supports for its incessant flux of action and creation. So you've probably recognized that we've completed one resolution of a duality in terms of existence, sat. Now we're taking up another in terms of consciousness power, chit. Chit Shakti and how she expresses herself. And you know what it refers to. Entering exclusively into the witness consciousness, Sakshi, he becomes silent, untouched, immobile. He sees that he has till now passively reflected and appropriated to himself the movements of nature, and it is by this reflection that they acquired from the witness soul within him what seemed a spiritual value and significance. So even the finest, most elegant aspects of what the material, intellectual, and aesthetic world offers, which we consider to be dear to ourselves, our most precious insights, all come from nature. And the witness soul can stand apart from it and realize itself as distinct from that. Sakshi. But now he has withdrawn that ascription or mirroring identification. He is conscious only of his silent self and aloof from all that is in motion around it. All activities are outside him, and at once they cease to be intimately real. They appear now mechanical, detachable, endable. Entering exclusively into the kinetic movement, he has an opposite self-awareness. He seems to his own perception a mass of activities, a formation and result of forces. If there is an active consciousness, even some kind of kinetic being in the midst of it all, yet there is no longer a free soul in it anywhere. So in the first, he's back inside, a witness consciousness, aloof and divorced from all. In the other, he's entirely engaged in the kinetic movement and can't find any substantial self anywhere in the flow of phenomena. These two different and opposite states of being alternate in him, or else stand simultaneously over against each other. One, silent in the inner being, observes, but is unmoved and does not participate. The other, active in some outer or surface self, pursues its habitual movements. He has entered into an intense, separative perception of the great duality, soul-nature, Purusha Prakriti. So we can have this as an alternating psychological experience of our being when we're most deeply posited. Then we are Purusha, the true person looking out. When we dance and weave and bob and play in the cosmic nature and delight in the regality of what costume we wear as a person, then we are the subject of Prakriti, and we can move from one to the other. We do until something gets fixed in us. But as the consciousness deepens, he becomes aware that this is only a first frontal appearance. For he finds that it is by the silent support, permission, or sanction of this witness soul in him that this executive nature can work intimately or persistently upon his being. If the soul withdraws its sanction, anumanta, the movements of nature in their action upon and within him become a wholly mechanical repetition, vehement at first, as if seeking still to enforce their hold, but afterwards less and less dynamic and real. And this is a genuine psychological experience. As we begin to divorce ourselves from that, to live in the freedom of the liberated soul within us, Purusha, and unhinge ourselves from nature, then nature tries more and more to grasp us. But if our idea is to live in the Purusha and then exert a pressure through sanction upon nature, nature wants to shrug that off and tries vehemently, violently, to say no. But if we are persistent in applying the will of the Purusha, then we can be successful, as he will say in a moment. More actively using this power of sanction or refusal, he perceives that he can, slowly and uncertainly at first, more decisively afterwards, change the movements of nature. Eventually, in this witness soul or behind it, is revealed to him the presence of a knower and master will in nature. And all her activities more and more appear as an expression of what is known and either actively willed or passively permitted by this Lord of her existence. So there's a lot in this. So we can change the movements of nature. Purusha can influence Prakriti. That indicates that there is not a real dualism there. Because if they are utterly detached, absolutely separate, the one could not influence the other. At best, we could somehow unlink ourselves and disappear into one. But this suggests that there is a connective power, a power that soul can place upon nature and influence and change it. Doesn't suggest it, he says it. And then he says about this distinction of the knower and master will. Remember, we're in the section dealing with consciousness power, chit shakti, the puissance of consciousness, the power of consciousness. Consciousness force, chit shakti, expresses itself as knowledge will. You'll remember this from the study of the life divine. So as we're above and sort of looking from the supreme trinity of being, sat, chit, ananda, chit is never absent force. Consciousness is never absent from force. So chit is always chit shakti. Chit shakti wants to unroll itself, to express itself dynamically, and how would it express its true being? But in terms of perfect self-knowledge, it would be knowledge. It would be Gnostic, G-N-O-S-T-I-C. And it would be unerring in its expression of power. Its will would fulfill itself. So knowledge and will are one with it above. So that is true there, but it is secretly true here, because supreme nature and lower nature are not absolutely separate. Remember, all is one. So what is supreme is here in the mundane, is immanent in this existence that we walk around on and in. So what is expressed by this conscious power as knowledge will, moving from the dark contrariety of existence towards more and more unified, evolved expressions of itself is governed by the Supreme Himself. If you want to express it like that, there is a Lord of the existence. This is the language Sri Aurobindo is using here. But ultimately, there is no distinction between the Lord, Ishwara, and the executive energy that does it all, Ishwari. Ishwara is Ishwari. Prakriti herself, he writes, now seems to be mechanical only in the carefully regulated appearance of her workings, but in fact a conscious force with a soul within her, a self-aware significance in her turns, a revelation of a secret will and knowledge in her steps and figures. So this is the enlarged experience of the yogin who can take all of this larger picture in, not simply resting in the eternal self, but seeing too that this consciousness energy is expressing itself in this world at the behest of the Supreme. This duality, an aspect separate, is inseparable. Wherever there is Prakriti, there is Purusha. Wherever there is Purusha, there is Prakriti. So this is a kind of polarity of being. One cannot exist without the other. Above, they are the same thing. Here we distinguish. Even in his inactivity, he holds in himself all her force and energies ready for projection. Even in the drive of her action, she carries with her all his observing and mandatory consciousness as the whole support and sense of her creative purpose. Once more, the seeker discovers in his experience the two poles of existence of one being and the two lines or currents of their energy, negative and positive, in relation to each other, which affect by their simultaneity the manifestation of all that is within it. Here too, he finds that the separative aspect is liberative, for it releases him from the bondage of identification with the inadequate workings of nature in the ignorance. The unitive aspect is dynamic and effective, for it enables him to arrive at mastery and perfection, while rejecting what is less divine or seemingly undivine in her. He can rebuild her forms and movements in himself according to a nobler pattern and the law and rhythm of a greater existence. So, the first station, liberative, gives you the realization. The second, aiming at mastery and perfection, gives you the siddhi, gives you the transformation. At a certain spiritual and supramental level, the duality becomes still more perfectly two in one, the master soul with the conscious force within it, and its potentiality disowns all barriers and breaks through every limit. Thus, this once separate, now Bayun duality of Purusha Prakriti is revealed to him in all its truth as the second great instrumental and effective aspect of the soul of all souls, the master of existence, the Lord of the sacrifice. Whether you see this as Shiva Shakti, Ishwara Ishwari, or in terms of the Gita and the Purushottama and the Paraprakriti, we're referring to the same reality. I think this is a good place to end for the evening, and we'll take up more of this chapter next time. But given the text that we just read, I think we should turn to Savitri, Book 1, The Book of Beginnings, Canto 4, The Secret Knowledge, and we're on page 60. All here, where each thing seems its lonely self, are figures of the soul transcendent one. Only by him they are, his breath is their life. An unseen presence molds the oblivious clay. A playmate in the mighty mother's game, one came upon the dubious whirling globe to hide from her pursuit in force and form. A secret spirit in the inconscient sleep, a shapeless energy, a voiceless word, he was here before the elements could emerge, before there was light of mind or life could breathe. Accomplice of her cosmic huge pretense, his semblances he turns to real shapes and makes the symbol equal with the truth. He gives to his timeless thoughts a form in time. He is the substance, he the self of things. She has forged from him her works of skill and might. She wraps him in the magic of her moods and makes of his myriad truths her countless dreams. The master of being has come down to her, an immortal child born in the fugitive years. In objects wrought, in the persons she conceives, dreaming she chases her idea of him and catches here a look and there a jest. Ever he repeats in them his ceaseless births. He is the maker and the world he made. He is the vision and he is the seer. He is himself the actor and the act. He is himself the knower and the known. He is himself the dreamer and the dream. There are two who are one and play in many worlds. In knowledge and ignorance they have spoken and met, and light and darkness are their eyes interchange. Our pleasure and pain are their wrestle and embrace. Our deeds, our hopes are intimate to their tale. They are married secretly in our thought and life. The universe is an endless masquerade, for nothing here is utterly what it seems. It is a dream-fact vision of a truth, which, but for the dream, would not be wholly true. A phenomenon stands out significant against dim backgrounds of eternity. We accept its face and pass by all it means. A part is seen, we take it for the whole. Thus have they made their play with us for roles. Author and actor with himself as seen, he moves there as the soul, as nature, she. Here on the earth, where we must fill our parts, we know not how shall run the drama's course. Our uttered sentences veil in their thought. Her mighty plan she holds back from our sight. She has concealed her glory and her bliss, and disguised the love and wisdom in her heart. Of all the marvel and beauty that are hers, only a darkened little we can feel. He too wears a diminished godhead here. He has forsaken his omnipotence, his calm he has foregone, and infinity. He knows her only. He has forgotten himself. To her he abandons all to make her great. He hopes in her to find himself anew, incarnate, wedding his infinity's peace to her creative passion's ecstasy. Although possessor of the earth and heavens, he leaves to her the cosmic management and watches all, the witness of her scene. A supernumerary on her stage, he speaks no words or hides behind the wings. He takes birth in her world, waits on her will, divines her enigmatic gesture's sense. The fluctuating chance turns of her mood, works out her meanings she seems not to know, and serves her secret purpose in long time. As one too great for him, he worships her. He adores her as his regent of desire. He yields to her as the mover of his will. He burns the incense of his nights and days, offering his life a splendor of sacrifice. A rapt solicitor for her love and grace, his bliss in her to him is his whole world. He grows through her in all his being's powers. He reads by her God's hidden aim in things. Or, a courtier in her countless retinue, content to be with her and feel her near, he makes the most of the little that she gives, and all she does drapes with his own delight. A glance can make his whole day wonderful. A word from her lips with happiness wings the hours. He leans on her for all he does and is. He builds on the largesses. He builds on her largesses. His proud, fortunate days, and trails his peacock-plumaged joy of life, and suns in the glory of her passing smile. In a thousand ways he serves her royal needs. He makes the hours pivot around her will, makes all reflect her whims. All is their play. This whole wide world is only he and she. Om Namaste Jai Ma.